It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll be talking about pie on this week's edition of Food Fight Friday as a baking instructor joins us to share tips on fillings, doughs, and everything else we need to know to make a great pie. But first, for over a century now, the federal government had forced indigenous children to attend boarding schools to unlearn their native heritage and assimilate into a white culture. Earlier this week, to mark Indigenous Peoples Day, Governor Tony Evers issued an apology for Wisconsin's participation in this practice. The governor also called for an investigation into the history of Indian boarding schools, mirroring an effort happening now at the federal level. To uncover what happened at these schools where unknown numbers of Indigenous children have died, we're talking about the history and the legacy of Indian boarding schools. We're talking about the truth and reconciliation. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. If you had relatives or ancestors who attended one of these Indian boarding schools in Wisconsin or in other states, how did that affect you and your family? We would like to hear your story this afternoon. Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Also up on our Facebook page today, or you can email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guests, Patty Lowe, professor at the Medill School of Journalism and director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. She's also the author of The Indian Nations of Wisconsin, Histories of Endurance, and a citizen of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. Patty, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Jay McGuetch, to my Native friends.
Also joining us this afternoon, Levi Rickert, who is the publisher and editor of Native News Online and the editor and publisher of Tribal Business News. Native News Online has been working on an ongoing investigation of Indian boarding schools. He's a citizen of the Prairie Band of Potawatomi Nation. And Levi, I'd like to welcome you back to Central Time as well.
Well, thank you, and McGuetch.
Patty, let's begin with your family's story and the way that Indian boarding schools impacted your family.
Yes, thank you. My grandfather, Edward Denamy, went to an Indian boarding school. Well, he was missionized at a school near the Keweenaw Indian Reservation in Michigan, where his mother lived, and then most of his schooling took place at the Toma Indian Boarding School in Wisconsin. His experience was very militarized. Children marched to the dining halls, they marched to the dormitories, they marched to their classes, and little boys drilled every morning at 6 a.m. with wooden rifles and little cadet uniforms. And so that militarization really became ingrained. And when World War I broke out, the exodus of Native boys into the military was tremendous. And my grandfather, like many, you know, almost 15,000 other Native Americans, enlisted in World War I. It was a seamless transition from the boarding schools to the training camps to the front lines. The Native soldiers experienced a casualty rate 5 times higher than any other group. So, you know, there were definite consequences.
Levi Rickert, tell us about your family's relationship and history with Indian boarding schools.
Well, my grandmother, Ellen Moore, she attended a boarding school in Genoa, Nebraska. Unfortunately, she never really talked to us about it. But from what I have learned as a Native person, number one, and then two, as a journalist, some of the ramifications have lived through our family as a result of her experience there. And I just feel like I'm happy, first of all, that you are highlighting this topic today, because it is a topic that many non-Natives don't even know about. And when you say boarding schools, oftentimes that's boarding schools are where wealthy people send their children off to. But when you talk about Indian boarding schools, you talk about a drastically different situation where they were met, as Patty just said, and good to hear your voice, Patty.
Levi. Bonjour.
Bonjour. And so, no, but it's just some really tragic findings that we are uncovering at Native News Online. And So I'm happy you are highlighting it today, Lee.
Well, we are talking about a federal government policy that was of family separation. So it still reverberates today, and the calls for truth and reconciliation, at least to some degree, seem to be louder than they have been before at the federal level. And now on Monday with the governor of Wisconsin, who when he announced his executive action and his formal apology, he said that at one time there were at least 10 Indian boarding schools in Wisconsin, and other students were... other children were shipped out of state. And Patty, right. I know this is about people and not numbers, but how can we get our handle on the scope of this story?
Yeah, you know, Lee, I spent about 30 years ago when I was working on my dissertation, I went down a rabbit hole of boarding school horror stories at the National Archives of the Great Lakes Indian Agency, which actually is here in Chicago. And you know, the stories that have come out of Kamloops really focus on the numbers of graves in that particular boarding school. But there were graveyards attached to almost every Indian boarding school across the country. And we think of this story really in terms of numbers, the numbers of human remains that turn up. But you know, my experience in the archives told, you know, it's horror stories of overcrowded conditions at the three government boarding schools in Wisconsin, children sleeping two and three to a bed. And so when tuberculosis and diphtheria and trachoma and influenza hit a community, it just swept through these boarding schools. You know, children received half an education. They learned to read, write, and do arithmetic in the morning. And then in the afternoons, they learned how to, you know, be good, subservient, second-class citizens, baking bread, washing floors, pitching hay. You know, they were groomed to become a second-class citizen. Some children rose above it, but overall, it was a really failed educational experience.
Our guest, Patty Lowe, joining us this afternoon, citizen of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and Levi Rickert, who is a citizen of the Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Nation. And Levi, one of the stories that is told are the children from Wisconsin who were shipped out to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School all the way in Pennsylvania. And some of the bodies that have been disinterred and brought home since then. But as I understand it, one Oneida Nation councilman is still calling for the return of more of these children.
Yes, and we actually had a reporter who went to Carlisle, Jenna Koontz, who's done an excellent job in reporting from Carlisle, and she will actually be going to Rosebud. We got a grant from the Annenberg Foundation to do some data collection, so we're really proud of some of that work. But yes, there are children that need to be returned, and one thing that was shocking to me this summer is that some people have been working on recovering their ancestors, their bodies of their ancestors for decades. And I'm talking 40, 50 years. And that is one of the things that I find very astounding is that a lot of people just haven't known about it. And as a journalist, I didn't even know about that they have spent decades, literally. And so we're going to have a live stream, Native News Online, in November, and it's one of the planning sessions we had just as recently as this afternoon, is to try to get some of the people who have been actively, give them a voice. They have been working diligently for decades, and they really have not had a voice. And so that's what we want to do. And it's whether it's Oneida, I don't really care where it is. We want to give voices to these families.
Why has it been so difficult to bring these remains home?
Well, quite frankly, the U.S. Army has a different interpretation of the Native American Repatriation Act, Graves Act, that goes back to 1990, that they don't feel like, because they are the U.S. Army, they don't have to adhere to that. And so we've done at least one article on it, and we would dispute that interpretation. And so we're going to try to put pressure on the U.S. Department of the Interior to say, take a side on it. So far, they've been somewhat neutral. And I know that Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, who actually is a member of the citizen of the Laguna Pueblo, She happens to be the first American Indian, Native American, whatever term you want to use, cabinet member in a presidential secretarial role. And so, number one, we as Native people are very, very proud that she's in that position. And I would doubt that we'd be as far as we are in terms of an investigation at the federal level had a non-Native been in that position. And so we're really proud of that. But we really need to see the Department of Interior fall on the side of families and try to tell the Army, U.S. Army, you have it wrong, folks. You need to agree to abide by what the federal law says about the return of these loved ones.
Levi Rickards, the editor and publisher of Native News Online and Tribal Business News, joined by Patty Lowe, who is the director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. And we want to hear from you this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234 if you've got a story to tell. We've got a forum for you. The federal government, the state of Wisconsin, are investigating what happened in Indian boarding schools, but is that enough? How should the government right the past wrongs that continue to affect Indigenous communities today? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to join us today. We'll pick up the conversation next here on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and let's pick up our talk with Patty Lowe and Levi Rickard about the legacy of Indian boarding schools here in our backyard and throughout North America, a scope which may be staggering, but the stories are individual, real, and continue to reverberate today. Patty Lowe is the director of the Center for Native American and Indigenous Research at Northwestern University, and Levi Rickard is the publisher and editor of Native News Online. And while the scope may be staggering, there are individual stories that help us understand why this legacy continues today and why there needs to be some sort of understanding of the truth and some attempt at reconciliation. Patty, would you share us the story of Lucy Skye?
Yes. I came across a batch of letters that were in response to a request by the Indian Agency of the LaPointe Agency in about, maybe 1910 or so, asking how their Indian girls were doing. These were letters sent to white farm women with whom Indian girls had been placed. Initially, Native children were allowed to go back to their reservations, but during the summertime, but so many of them didn't return in the fall because their parents hid them that they came up with something called the outing system, where they would place Indian children from boarding schools with white families to work over the summer. And these children were definitely exploited. I mean, they were getting between 25 cents and a dollar a week, where the prevailing domestic servant wage in a rural area was about $2.75. So these children were working six days a week, 12 hours a day. And I remember just kind of collapsing I'd been in this archive reading, just these horror stories. And it was this batch of letters that just brought me to my knees. One of the women was writing about this young 16-year-old girl from Lac des Flambeaux and saying that she wasn't worth the 25 cents she paid for her that summer, because all she did was stand in a corner and cry when she wasn't on task. And she reported she wasn't foolishly spending her money because they lived 25 miles out of town. And so there was no place for her to go to spend money. And they tried, they magnanimously offered to take her to church every Sunday and she refused. And I'm thinking about this poor young girl being isolated, and heartsick and broken, and the arrogance of this woman was just overwhelming to me. And these are the kinds of stories that I think people need to hear so they really understand the trauma that these children went through.
Do we have any idea what became of Lucy Skye?
You know, I don't. I think she has relatives on the Flambeau and Bad River reservations. And this is, another thing that I'm really interested in is connecting some of these ancestor stories with people, contemporary people that are still surviving and thriving on reservations. Because, Lee, we talk about generational trauma, but Native people did not survive because of generational trauma. We survived because of generational ingenuity and creativity and, you know, these stories need to be told. How did we get from this 16-year-old exploited girl to her relatives that are still living and thriving today?
And Levi Rickert, while I cannot see you, I have to imagine you are nodding your head in agreement. As you point out, there are people who went to Indian boarding schools, children who went to Indian boarding schools that are actually younger than you are today. Still around.
That's true. And we here in Michigan, we had the Holy Childhood up in Indian school up in Harbor Springs, Michigan. And that did not close until 1984. I interviewed and has not been published yet, but I interviewed a young man who actually attended there and listened to his stories. Just as Patty said, these are some horrific stories that you listen to. And when you talk to the other people, such as the chairperson of the Little Traverse Bay Band of the Odawa Indians, she went to a boarding school. She tells at this particular school is run by Catholics, and the nuns actually molested and raped the boys. And the Grand Rapids Press did a really good job, I want to say 1993, of reporting this. And so I talked to one of the reporters recently, and he told me that it was just really unbelievable back then. And so, Lee, by the time some of the stories broke out in Philadelphia with the priest, it was not shocking to Native people. We knew these stories. And so, but back to the tribal chairwoman up, she talks about her brother was molested and how he would never marry. He never wanted to touch a woman. And we were at the Straits of Mackinac, actually at a Line 5 protest or rally up there. And she looked out into the Straits of Mackinac and with this, she said he would have made a great father, but he never wanted to touch a woman because he had been raped by these nuns. And so those kind of stories are just horrific. And there are countless. And that's the shame of what happened. And Patty talks about intergenerational trauma. And I think that's what our people are going through right now. And we at Native News call it a time of reckoning. It's time for us to really take the bull by the horns and tell these stories, but at the same time, look at how we can heal as a community and move forward. But I think before we can heal, and healing, as we know, is not a one-time, you can't go to a one-time event and think everything's going to be great. It's a lifelong journey, the healing process. And I think that's what I think is somewhat remarkable with Deb Holland's initiative. It's going to allow us to really reckon with what we have to face and talk about it. And Patty, you can weigh in here. I know people just will not talk about it because go ahead, Patty.
Right. Well, I was just going to say, you're absolutely right. I mean, some of the trauma is so deep, but what I find really remarkable is, you know, this horrible failed educational experiment that was conducted on Native people. Some Native children took the tools of assimilation. You know, they're forced to read, write in a different language and give up their. And people like John Echohawk, who founded the Native American Rights Fund, they used the tools of assimilation as weapons to fight for Indian treaty rights and sovereignty. And I find that to be, you know, some comfort in all of this. Boarding schools were a terrible idea, but yet, you know, there were some children that not only survived, but managed to turn that experience into motivation to help them fight for their people.
Using the tools of assimilation for liberation. From our guest, Patty Lowe, a citizen of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe, also joined by Levi Rickert, who is a citizen of the Prairie Band of the Potawatomi Nation, as we take a look at the legacy of Indian boarding schools and what comes next. And there's another unintended consequence, Patty, that I'd like to bring up, and that is for many ancestors of survivals, the struggle for tribal membership and benefits is a result of Indian boarding schools.
You know, that's the really interesting story. You know, a lot of our grandparents met in Indian boarding schools, and I think this is why Native America is so pan-Indian, and it also is, has a lot of solidarity. But, you have intermarriage, and the children of those original unions may be marrying outside their tribe, and then their children marry outside their tribe. And so we have full-blood Native children who are one-eighth Ho-Chunk and one-eighth Lakota Ray, one-eighth Odawa, one-eighth, a Pueblo, and not enough blood quantum to be a legal, a legal citizen of any particular tribe. And this is another problem that is really causing a lot of anxiety in Indian country.
With a couple minutes that we have left, what steps are next and what role can we play? Levi, I'll ask you first.
Well, we are, at Native News Online, we are going to do some live streams just to really educate our people. I say we know a lot about it, but truthfully, there's a lot to learn. I'm learning every single day from this experience through our investigation. But we're waiting the result of the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative established by Deb Haaland. And they the charge is that they will have a report back to the secretary on April 1st. So we are really anxiously wanting to see what those results look like. I think that they're going to come back with, there were like 370 boarding schools across the United States, and they didn't really have enough time and enough money to do a good job. So I really think they're going to ask for an extension, but I think that there's a lot of work to be done.
Patty, what role can we play?
Well, the boarding schools robbed entire generations of Native people of our languages, our culture, our ceremonies, and this is really creating a lot of anxiety in our communities because culture is embedded in the language. So when Native people are able to take charge of their own education, and I'll mention Wadoka Dadding and Lakota Ray, the Indian Community School of Milwaukee. When Native people are left to solve our own problems and people aren't standing in the way, we do marvelous things. I like to quote my colleague Pam Silas, who's Menominee Oneida. She said, we don't need people to lift us up. We just need people, to have our back. We know what we need. I think the federal government could give us some resources to
empower,
really enrich our Native educational program.
Thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Patty Lowe is the director of the Center for Native American Indigenous Research at Northwestern University. Levi Rickard is the publisher and editor of Native News Online. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Oh my, it's Pi Day on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and aren't I lucky? First, coming up Monday at 8 on the morning show, you get to meet the breakup coach and dating strategist. She offers best practices for relationships and some even better lessons for building the boundaries around them. Join Natalie Juarez along with Kate Archer-Kent Monday morning after 8 on the morning show here on the Ideas Network. Now it's Food Friday, and this week we're going to Pie Camp. Our next guest has been baking pies for decades and made just about every type of pie you can think of, and she's proven it with her books. She's here with some tips on how to get it right, or at least close, every time. And I'm here to testify as well with my, I think, the best old-fashioned apple pie is a recipe from our guest, but I made it pretty good. We'll want to hear from you this afternoon as we talk about pie and your pie stories at 1-800-642-1234. What's your favorite type of pie to bake or to eat? Are they the same or different? Is there a fruit you look forward to being in season every year for that pie? You like cream or custard? What makes it for you and why? With pies this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. And yes, we will talk about the crust as well. And you can chime in on our Facebook page if you choose. Kate McDermott is a baker, teacher, author of several books, and the host of Real Pie Camps. Her books include the James Beard Award-nominated Art of the Pie. Her latest book is Pie Camp, the skills you need to make any pie you want. You can follow her work at artofthepie.com. And Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Lee, it's a pleasure to be here. I always love to talk about my favorite subject, which I know you know what it is.
Well, why is it your favorite subject? And as I was thinking about what it was for pies, to me, it boils down to my grandma and my great aunt and the way their house smelled when you'd walk in. It would smell like cinnamon and apples, and it smelled like home.
It does. I think there is something that is so unique to pie that it is so much more than just a list of ingredients. The most important ingredient that we put into that pie pan with everything is love. And I think love consists of all these memories. It's not just that flavor of the perfect apple pie. It's the flavor of our lives.
Mm. So for you, how far back does pie go? When? What are your memories like?
Oh, my goodness. That's opening a big, big chapter there. I have been baking since I was a little girl. My grandmother was the pie maker in our family. We called her Gigi. And she could whip out pies without even thinking. She had been raised on an Iowa farm. She was the youngest of five daughters. And she would just come to the counter. I lived in a multi-generational home. She lived with us. And, you know, it was like, can you make a pie? Well, you know, there they were. It just was something that I learned, like you would learn to, you know, like, okay, we're going to brush our teeth now. We're going to make a pie. That's just life.
Pie is life. I absolutely appreciate that. And that seems to come to bear with your new book, Pie Camp, as you have three rules of pie making and life. Number one, keep everything chill, especially yourself. Duly noted. Number two, keep your boundaries. I get that. And number three, vent. Rather philosophical,
yes.
Kate.
Oh, well, thank you very much. You know, the subtitle of my first book that did receive the James Beard nomination, it's Art of the Pie, A Practical Guide to Homemade Crusts, Fillings, and Life.
Yes.
And one of my alter ego is I am the psychiatrist, and she does answer questions both about pie and life. So how can I help you today, Lee?
Well, let's start with the crust, which I thought you made very easy for me, somebody who has not made crust before, but has certainly purchased it in the aisle at the grocery store. So for you, it's really simple. It's about flour, salt, and fat, but it's what you do with that and the temperature you bring it that matters, right?
Yes, I think rule number one, which is to keep everything chilled,
yeah,
especially yourself, is to keep all those ingredients cool. Butter starts melting or getting soft at 59 degrees, and you don't want to have greasy, greasy butter when you're working with your flour. So you do want to have things a little chilled, and also, and that includes your environment and your hands. If you have hot hands, well, maybe hold some ice cubes and chill out a little bit. You could always hold a margarita that's iced also.
From the psychiatrist, your recommendation. But you, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, our guest is Kate McDermott, and she is the author of Pie Camp. We'd be interested from you this afternoon to hear what your pie stories might be and why pie is home to you, or as she puts it, pie is life. This is a twist on a Ted Lasso quote. And as we are talking about the crust, I should mention that I tried the best old-fashioned apple pie recipe from Kate McDermott last night. I brought in a piece for our engineer, Tyler Ditter, this afternoon. He's kind enough not to eat it in front of me so I don't get the instant review. But it was relatively easy, and it was simple. And as long as you keep it simple, like I did not, here's the thing that I just realized for the first, I did not cut the peels off the apples last night when I put it in the apple pie, per Kate's recommendation. Kate, I never thought of that before because it's always been an unpeeled apple that goes into an apple pie, but why? And after I took a bite of your best apple pie recipe last night, I figured I'll probably never peel an apple again.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, I eat apples with peels on them. Why would I be peeling them to go into the pie? Now, that being said, there are several apples that I do peel because they may have a bit of a tougher crust. And those would be a Granny Smith,
mm-hmm,
and also the new Cosmic Crisps, which if you haven't tried one, if you can get a hold of one of those, they're just delicious. But they do have just a bit of a little of a peel that you might want to peel those. Otherwise, I just let them in there. But if you want to peel your apples, be my guest. It's whatever works for you.
The apple filling that I used for the best old-fashioned apple pie recipe also included an apple cider vinegar, an apple liqueur, sugar, cinnamon. It was two scrapes of a nutmeg and a little bit of allspice, and that really, what you mix it up with a little bit of flour, and that's your filling.
That's it. You know, I truly believe that the simpler we can make things, the better. The most important flavor that we need, though, is what I call pie-worthy fruit. If your fruit has no flavor, your pie, your filling will have very little flavor. Also, you may end up just tasting sugar and spices and not that delicious apple.
Well, let's go to Martha in Menominee this afternoon. Martha, tell us a little bit about your pie-making experiences.
You know, I'm like Kate. I've been making them all my life. Never bought a store crust. Bought, you know, always made my own. And I'm wondering if this is about apple pie now. We're coming into that season. Maybe Kate can help me with a problem that's plagued me all these years. My top crust on my apple pies does not follow the sinking of the apples as they cook. So every time I take my apple pie out of the oven, the top crust, which I've done vented, non-vented, crimped, not, you know, I've tried every kind. It always has a big airspace between the apples and the top crust. And when Kate said pie is love, I thought she had read that murder mystery, Lie Down with Dogs, where the heroine says, quote, pie is love. So I had to call. It's one of my favorite
Oh,
books. And so I had to
Martha.
call.
Martha, I need to know what that book is because I haven't read that. But you know what you're talking about is the Grand Canyon in the apple pie. And there are a couple things that I can suggest that you might try. So one of them is to put all the ingredients, mix up all the ingredients for your filling, and then place all of that into a braising pan or something, and then turn your heat on to medium low and let your filling start to cook down until you can just start to get a fork easily into it. You know, not so it's like, oh, it's mush, but so it's partially cooked. Then let it cool completely. Put it into a nice chilled pie crust, your dough, and then top it off. Your apples ideally will have already done their slump. Now, another thing that we can do is to actually not fill the pie pan so high that we have the big mounded one, but maybe slice them into smaller sizes and then layer them in there. Either way, I think you'll have some success, and I would love to know how that goes for you, Martha.
By the way, I'm not the only one that can try our guest Kate McDermott's best old-fashioned apple pie recipe. You can find that recipe online right now at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try it out and let us know how you fare. Our conversation and the recipes continue for Food Friday with our guest, the author of The Art of the Pie and her latest book, Pie Camp, The Skills You Need to Make Any Pie You Want. Your pie stories as well at 1-800-642-1234. Your pie questions about crust, filling, what do you need to know to make it so sweet? We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. Sweet Food Friday on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and our conversation continues with Kate McDermott, baker, teacher, author of the new book, Pie Camp, The Skills You Need to Make Any Pie You Want, and it is complete. Your questions as well about the perfect pie at 1-800-642-1234, where Doug from Colfax is standing by. Doug, what would you like to ask our guest, Kate?
Hi, I'm a pecan pie fan, and my wife is nice enough to make them for me sometimes. And we have bees, and so she substitutes half the sugar with honey. And I was wondering what your pie expert thought of that. Would that work for other pies?
Interesting.
And, Doug, I you kind of broke up there. Did you say what kind of a pie was that?
Pecan.
Oh, pecan. Absolutely. Yes, you can.
Oh, we just lost our guest, Kate, so we will get her back momentarily. But I want to remind you that, as always, for Food Friday, we throw the recipes up online for you at WPR.org/Food Friday. And the other recipe that we have available for you this afternoon is the Nana Banana Cream Pie. It, according to Kate, is the best cream pie she's ever had. Now, what it is that makes that cream pie so special, maybe it starts with a crust, maybe the chantilly cream, or perhaps that luscious cream filling. And also, what does it have to do with bananas? As Kate mentioned, it's about the fruit and whether or not the fruit, the taste of the fruit dictates the taste of the pie. And you got to see the cover of her book, Pie Camp, because it's this fruit pie that looks like something you would never make, with lattice on top that's irregular. One's thick, one's thin, another one's woven. You get some braided on top there. And it's at the end of the day, it just looks sort of like a fun make-your-own sort of recipe, which is exactly what I did last night and what Kate McDermott's book, Pie Camp, encourages you to do. What we have available at 1-800-642-1234, The Art of Making Pie, The Science of the Crust and the Filling that Goes with It. You got to WPR.org/Food Friday for the recipes that we have for you this afternoon. Also in her book is this description of the sounds that pies make. You wouldn't think of listening for your pie to find out whether or not it's ready. But when a fruit pie is done, Kate McDermott says you hear the call of the sizzle wump. I have no idea what the sizzle wump is. Kate's back with us now. I'm grateful because you got to figure this out for me. What is the sizzle wump, Kate?
The sizzle wump is the sound a double crust pie makes when it is ready to come out of the oven. You get your ear right down close to the top of that top crust, and it makes a sizzling sound. And the bubbling of the filling underneath it will hit the inside of the upper crust, making a whomping noise. Some folks would perhaps call this the pie's heartbeat.
The pie's heartbeat.
You like that?
The sizzle womp. It makes it sound like it would be louder, but you really got to lean in to hear it, right?
Oh, you do. I remember I was in the kitchen once with a big, big apple pie, and I was kept hearing this, like, what is this? And I got my ear right down to the top of the pie. And somebody came in my kitchen and I said, what are you doing? I said, we're listening to the pie. And they said, well, what do you call that? And I said, a sizzle wump.
There you go, a sizzle wump. The heartbeat of the pie at 800-642-1234. The other recipe that we have on our website is the Nana Banana Cream Pie, which, according to Kate McDermott, the best cream pie you've ever had. And it begins with the crust, which is peanut butter cookies, Kate?
Yes, you can easily make a press-in crust. Cookie crumb crusts are so easy. Buzz them up in a food processor, or take a rolling pin, put the cookies in a plastic bag and roll them up until they're fine, and then put a little more sugar in there and some butter. Press that into a pie pan, and you're going to put it into the oven for just a little bake to set that. And then you let it cool, and you make a delicious, luscious pastry cream, and you put that into your little baked cookie crumb crust there. Mm. And then you put some sliced bananas on top. And if you're really feeling fancy, you sprinkle some sugar on top of that and take your blowtorch and give them a little color.
Nana Banana Cream Pie up on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to Kay in Milwaukee now, who joins us with our guest, Kate McDermott. Kay, good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm really interested in savory pies.
Mm.
So you like the meat pies that you get in England and Australia, and haven't had much luck. So I don't know, is the crust different, and how do you make that gravy nice and
And, oh, I can help you there. So, yes, it is different. I went to England and actually learned how to make a hand-raised pork pies from an award-winning baker there. And it does take a hot water crust, and you can find that recipe I've got in my first book of how to make traditional English pork pies. It is a hot water crust. It's a different technique. Or you can also do a search online for that. Doesn't have to be mine. And then your filling, the pork pies, of course, are pork. They're very simply seasoned. And they to get that jelly around the pork pie, you actually take some bouillon and with gelatin in it, and you take like a turkey baster, and you put that in at the very last when the pie comes out of the oven. Oh. And apparently what I learned is that it is not a proper pork pie unless it has the jelly.
Well, you want it to be actually, you just want it to be tasty. We've got Roger in Grantsburg to follow up on Kay's call. Thank you, Kay. Roger, what do you have to add?
We just got fielded there with the making of meat pies. My mom used to always made a meat pie and she'd like saute up some chicken and turkey and whatever and vegetables and stuff and like in a brown gravy and then dumped it in the pie and baked it and then whatever. And it's like I hadn't heard her say anything about meat pie till just before I called.
So, oh, well, I think Roger, you are so right. There's nothing that you cannot put into that pie crust. I think, you know, I often will say, you know, what have you got in your fridge? What have you got around? And then if you want to make, you know, that savory pie, whether it's chicken or your leftover vegetables or whatever, a humble pie is anything and everything, and it's all good.
I was fortunate in making your recipe for the best old-fashioned apple pie last night that I had the pie crust roller from the Friends of McFarland Public Library, who were around before there was a McFarland Public Library. They used to make hundreds of pies at once, and so I'm not judging here at all, Kate, but I do want to know, just for future reference, how do you prevent, when it comes to a pie, prevent a soggy bottom?
Oh, well, first of all, you want to make sure that you put a well-chilled pie into a hot oven. If you put a warm or a, you know, kind of a namby-pamby, I'm not really chilly crust into the oven, it's going to say, oh, I'm at the beach, I'm going to relax now. But if you put a well-chilled pie into a hot oven, it says, ah, and it holds its shape. But you want to also make sure that bottom of the pie gets onto a hot surface first. So you might want to preheat, when you're preheating your oven, put a sheet pan or a cookie tin down there so it gets hot, or even the pizza stone, and bake your pie on that low setting there, low in the oven with your high heat when you first put it in, and so that bottom crust can set.
And again, we've got the recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention there's a lot more apple pie recipes and fruit pie recipes and cream pie recipes and things that are beyond pie recipes in your new book, Pie Camp. And if you were to say there is a takeaway for making pie today, Kate McDermott, what would it be?
To be happy and make pie.
Kate McDermott, baker, teacher, and piecatrist, thank you so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much. I hope to talk with you again, and pie on.
Kate McDermott, baker and teacher, author of several books. We've been talking about her latest, Pie Camp, the skills you need to make any pie you want. You can find two of the recipes we talked about today for the best old-fashioned apple pie and that Nana Banana cream pie with a peanut butter cookie crumble crust on our website at WPR.org/Food Friday. And I thank you all for chiming in with pies this morning, and look forward to the report from our engineer on the best pretty good apple pie that I made last night. Coming up Monday on Central Time, organized labor flexing its muscles, and we're seeing it in the headlines with strikes from workers responsible for Kellogg's cereals, John Deere tractors, movies, TV, and live theater. What's the story behind the headlines, and what does that mean for the balance between capital and labor in our current economy? We'll take a look at that, as well as the warehouse jobs that are available and the workers that aren't showing up. That's Monday, coming up on Central Time. So today is National Cheese Curd Day, which could be just any old day here in Wisconsin. But thanks to an April Fool's joke that cheese fans demanded become a reality, today was the day to get your Curder Burger from Culver's Restaurants. Heard Brady talking about it in the news. One day only, Culver's turned their social media post from April Fool's Day promoting their butter burger topped with a big fried cheese curd into a cheesy reality. If you didn't pick up a Curder Burger, I'm sorry. I understand most, if not all, have been sold out for hours now, but we are fortunate to have a journalist join us with their one-of-a-kind Curder Burger review. Jesse O'Poyan is the Capital Bureau Chief for the Capital Times. Jesse, when did your excursion start this morning?
Oh, I got in line sometime between 9:45 and 9:48, and I was the fourth person in line at the location that I was at.
And please report back. What is your food review?
It's delicious. So you've got a Culver's Deluxe, which is a great burger already, and what they call the curd that they put on top of it, they call it a cheese crown. It's kind of like a big disc of cheese curd all melted into one, breaded, fried, put on top of this burger. And the crown, I can report, is fitting of a royal burger. It is delicious. It was actually worth the hype, which I think we were all a little nervous. Might not be the case. It was really good.
Jesse O'Poyan, happy National Cheese Curd Day.
Happy National Cheese Curd Day.
Thank you very much. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.